everyone. Welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. Today is Tuesday, March 21st. Amanda Borchel-Dan here, joined by our editor, David Horowitz, and environment reporter, Sue Sarks. Hello to you both.
Good morning.
Hey, Amanda. Hi, Sue.
David will weigh in on the frantic push to complete parts of the judicial overhaul package before Passover. Sue is here to fill us in on a newly released United Nations report on how to perhaps mitigate climate change and how the cranes are faring this year in the Chula Valley. And for dessert, Israel was ranked by a UN-sponsored index as the fourth happiest nation in the world. But first, a word from our sponsor.
The Technion Israel Institute of Technology is where some of Israel's brightest minds ask the biggest question of all. What if? What if they could take on the world's biggest challenges? What if they could develop life-changing environmental, scientific, health, medical, and technological discoveries that will make a huge impact on Israel and the planet? But they don't just ask the question, they answer it too. They turn those ideas into reality. They make them happen. To see just some of the incredible things they've achieved, get the Technion Booklet of Wonders at ats.org/wonders. We hope it inspires you to give them your support so they can keep doing what they do best. The American Technion Society. World-changing discoveries by Israel's brightest minds, made possible by you.
And we're back. Late Sunday and early Monday, Chaver Knesset MK Simcha Rotman published a revised version of the bill changing the mechanism of judicial appointments. The updated proposal may be brought before Rothman's Constitution, Law and Justice Committee today to be readied for its second and third, which is the final reading in the plenum. However, the Knesset's legal advisor stated it is preferable to hold another committee hearing prior to voting on the bill. This is a moving story, of course, and listeners, you should look for updates on the website. Now, our legal affairs reporter, Jeremy Sharon, spoke about this briefly yesterday on the podcast. But David, can you remind listeners what the new bill is before we dive into its significance?
Well, it was presented by Simcha Rotman, the committee chair, Knesset Constitution Committee chair, as a softening of the original legislation and described as that to some extent as well by Yariv Levine, the justice minister. And it was castigated by members of Likud yesterday in a faction meeting, by some of them at least, as being too soft. But in fact, when you look at it closely, it's not terribly different to the original draconian legislation, which the Deputy Attorney General has warned raises concerns about the politicization of the court. I'm paraphrasing here. It represents the political takeover of the entire system of appointing judges and high court justices in Israel. And therefore, it's the beginning of the end of the separation of powers because we will no longer have an independent judiciary. Why do I say that? When the original legislation gave the coalition automatic capability to appoint all Israeli justices, whereas this one doesn't quite do that because effectively it amounts to almost the same thing. Under the quote-unquote softened proposal that the coalition is now pushing through in its determination, trying to get it done by, I mean, presumably they could even do it early next week if they want to. They can certainly do it in the course of next week, which is their goal. Under the revised proposal, the coalition has enough votes on the amended Judicial Selection Committee to choose the first two High Court justices when seats open up on the bench in the term of every Knesset. And it also has overwhelming influence, not absolute influence, but overwhelming influence on any subsequent appointments to the High Court in its term. Justices have a mandatory retirement age of 70, and therefore, when you've got a bench of 15, not that many reach retirement age in each term of a coalition of a Knesset. The average one Knesset member has calculated is 2.6. So the first two of every 2.6 opponents in each Knesset term will be automatically the province of the coalition. After that, it's quite a complicated formula, but basically after that, they'll need the support of an opposition member for the third appointment and the support of an opposition member and a justice on the committee for fourth and further members. But it's near complete control. And in terms of appointment to the lower courts, you will need 7 votes on the committee to choose judges in the lower court hierarchies. The coalition will have 6, and a member of the judiciary would be necessary as a 7th. But remember now, under the process I already described for the High Court, the coalition will have chosen some of the justices and will be able to put somebody that it has chosen on this panel, thereby giving it the 7th vote and the capacity to make all appointments in the lower courts. Just to add one little nuance to explain that a little bit further, the process by which the High Court chooses its president has hitherto been a function of seniority, whoever's been on the bench longest. In the coalition's legislation as it stands, that seniority system will not apply. The coalition will be choosing the president of the Supreme Court. The president will be part of the nomination process or can even sit on the Judicial Selection Committee, and therefore that's that 7th vote if the coalition needs it for all the appointments to the lower courts, and that would be the judicial voice that it would have in the selection of High Court justices from the 4th justice and onward. I tried to explain that coherently. It is quite complicated, and of course that's part of the idea, because the coalition has presented this as some kind of dramatic softening to take into account concerns that it is bent on taking over the judiciary. Yariv Levine last night absurdly said it is not our intention to politicize this process and to take control. Well, that's exactly what this legislation will do.
Now, Yariv Levine also said that the intervention of the court, should it step in to strike down this legislation, would be a red line that we won't accept. We've been talking for weeks, actually. Is this the constitutional crisis moment? Is this the moment? Do you think that this judicial appointments bill could be actually the moment?
Well, I would step back one second before I address that and highlight the outrageousness of that comment by Levine. A politician who purports to respect the separation of powers, who purports not to want to take control of the High Court, warning the justices of Israel it will be a red line if they reach the conclusion that the legislation he is advancing does not reflect Israel's foundational and essential democratic principles. He's telling them, don't you dare do it. Well, it's their job. It's their democratic job to weigh this legislation and reach their independent decision, not to be battered by a justice minister disingenuously claiming not to want to politicize the court and warning them not to do it. So that would be the first thing that I would say. In terms of the constitutional crisis, we're in the midst of a rolling constitutional crisis where a duly elected majority is attempting to use its power to gain absolute control over all the branches of governance in Israel. At the risk of repeating myself, you know, in terms of 3 branches of governance, we only have 2. When you have a like-minded coalition, a like-minded executive, the legislature cannot put the brakes on any excesses. And therefore, it's only our judges, it's only the High Court that can stop moves that, in this case, potentially would open the door to the abuse of the most basic rights in Israel, the most basic human rights in Israel. They are not protected under this legislative package that the coalition is advancing. They're not protected from abuse by the governing majority, and the court will be denied the capacity to intervene. That's what's playing out here. So we're in the midst, like I say, of a major constitutional crisis. How it plays out now? Well, you know, your question is right in that assuming this law, this terrible law, goes through next week, there will be petitions to the High Court. We heard the opposition leader, Yair Lapid, yesterday saying he'll appeal to the High Court. He won't be the only one. Reflecting, indeed, what's at stake here, that he will be able to appeal to the justices, and the elected majority, the justice minister of the elected majority, is warning the judges not to do their job. What will the court do? You know, nobody knows for sure. I have heard people analyzing and saying they do not think the justices will intervene on this part of the legislation, on the legislation that relates to the selection of the justices themselves. I think that those analysts are wrong. I think the High Court will emphatically initially suspend the legislation amid concerns that it is undemocratic and illegal. And then I tend to think, and I'm not a legal expert, and I'm basing myself on the range of scholarly views that I've heard presented and the explanations, I think it's very likely that the court will strike it down, and the political leadership will say you don't have the right to strike it down, and then we're deeper still in the constitutional crisis, and we've heard the justice minister telling us he won't accept it. Well, you know, so then what happens to this wonderful democratic country that we have had here? You know, I dread to think. I heard Benny Gantz, who has been perhaps the most statesmanlike of any of the opposition leaders in, I mean, that's his character anyway, saying things yesterday. Like, I almost plead with the prime minister to stop this. You know, it was lovable in the candor and the despair. And I heard Lapid, he was asked, are you going to try and encourage people to suspend the protests, at least while the state ceremonies are taking place for Israel's 75th anniversary next month? And he said, you know, that's a fair way off. You know, at the rate we're going, who knows if we're even going to have a state next month. I mean, that was an off the cuff remark that I'm not sure, maybe he would have made it if he thought it through, but it's a reflection of the abyss of despair that some opponents of this legislation find themselves in.
We're going to a short break now.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like, my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him on, like, after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their, like, blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. Sue, turning to you, the United Nations released its Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's sixth assessment synthesis report yesterday. Let's focus on Israel. It's a global report, but we're going to focus on the Holy Land. Now, I understand that temperatures rose by about 1.4 degrees Celsius between 1950 and 2017, and that not only are we not meeting our emissions goals, we're actually moving in the wrong direction. Can you break this down for us?
It's a grave report. I mean, it does have a long list of steps that can be taken to mitigate climate change and possibly even to keep within the 1.5 degree temperature rise that was agreed in Paris in 2015. But it says, you know, we're on track to breach 1.5 and we're even on the way to breaching a 2 degree rise, which will mean a much bigger rise in Israel. It's not enough to move this government fast enough. It certainly isn't enough to move other governments fast enough. And in Israel, that's partly because the finance ministry just still doesn't get it. The previous government tried but failed to get a climate law passed that would anchor the government's commitments to cut emissions. And there's no sign yet that the current environment minister, Idit Silman, will fare any better. So far, this government has shown itself not only to be indifferent to climate change, but totally insensitive to the environment. It's included a long list of proposals to weaken environmental protection in the Economic Arrangements Bill, which accompanies the state budget. And of course, there's a rush now to extract as much fossil fuel gas from the Mediterranean, with the fourth exploration tender out now. So it does really feel that we are going in the wrong direction.
Sue, you also took a trip up to the Hula Valley recently, and I believe you were counting cranes, not crows, cranes.
Yeah, I wasn't exactly counting them. You know, you can go up to the Hula Lake, and you go into a kind of truck, They take you to the lake. The birds don't know that there's humans as long as you don't get up and dance about. And you see this incredible scene just before sunset of thousands and thousands of birds coming in to land on the lake where they feel safer during the night. Nobody really knows how many cranes pass through Israel because a lot of the migration is done at night. This is really about how many cranes spend the winter here rather than flying from Europe to Africa until the spring. Now, in recent years, there have been about 40,000 overwintering here. This year, there were anything from 18,000 to 25,000. There's no exact figures, and the question is why. So just to contextualize things, Israel is a land bridge between Africa and Europe. It's really an essential stopping point either before or after the birds fly over the Sahara Desert. You see them coming into Israel absolutely exhausted. And many of Israel's valleys used to be full of marshland where the birds could stop and eat and re-tank. But these have been dried out for development and agriculture. In the Hula Valley, which is in northern Israel, the authorities re-flooded a part of the land and created a lake, which has become a huge tourist attraction because hundreds of thousands of birds congregate there and fly onto the lake just before sunset. This is part of the something like 500 million birds that pass through Israel twice a year between Africa and Europe during the spring and autumn migrations. The issue is that there's many conflicting interests there. The birds used to feed on the farmers' fields, which of course infuriated the farmers. So the Nature and Parks Authority started to feed them to keep them off the fields. And because there was readily available food, many of the cranes decided to stay for the winter. The result was overcrowding. There were, as I say, something like 40,000 of them over recent years, and that left them very vulnerable to disease. And as we all painfully remember, that came last year with a massive outbreak of bird flu. They said around 8,000 birds were killed, but it could be a huge underestimate. So this year, fearing another outbreak, the Nature and Parks Authority sat down with the farmers and all the other bodies involved to decide how to operate. And they agreed on a 5-year plan to phase out the feeding. But the government fell before they could get an agreement on compensating farmers for damage to crops. So for this year, they started feeding later at the end of December and finished earlier at the end of February. And they also reduced the amount of food by 10%. Normally, they would have fed from the end of November, beginning of December, and gone on until March, which explains why when I went a week ago, there were no cranes to be seen on the field where they've been fed in previous years. The truck used to stop in the field and you'd be surrounded by cranes and this cacophony of noise. I just saw cranes flying in and landing straight on the water just before dark. It is still an incredibly moving experience. The grey cranes are still migrating through Israel, depending on the weather. They will probably do so until, say, the end of April. The pelicans are there at the moment. It's really worth a visit.
It surely is. Sue, thank you for that.
Pleasure.
David, we've talked about a lot of dire things in this podcast, from the political situation to climate change. And the UN-sponsored World Happiness Index rankings that were revealed yesterday found that Israelis are the happiest they've ever been in over a decade and were placed fourth, which is up from ninth from last year. Obviously, it should be noted that the index was composed prior to our almost 3 months of grassroots protests over the judicial overhaul. But David, do you have any insight into what makes Israelis generally so darn happy?
Look, the first thing that I looked at yesterday when I saw the survey, and obviously we've all followed this for years, was, well, how do they calculate that again? So as you say, it's an averaging of 2020 to 2022. We've always been pretty happy here. You know, it's the highest position in a decade, but they've only been doing the survey for a decade. And I think it's because Israelis don't take this country for granted. I also think it reflects that we were doing quite well, relatively speaking, in healing rifts and living in some kind of harmony across all those ostensible divides. And, you know, being brief about this, for me, the concern is that we will not be as high when they do this survey next year, because so many of these rifts are reemerging around the overhaul of our democracy. I'd love to be wrong, but I think it kind of underlines the imperative of the hour. We have been a very happy people. We don't take this country for granted, and we need to revive that recognition of the need for internal harmony and coherence and a bit of, you know, mutual respect and tolerance.
David, thank you so much for that. And thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Amanda.
Pleasure. Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. And thanks to our producer, Gilad Brownstein, and to Gili Amar for this out-of-this-world music.
You can find us daily wherever you find your podcasts.
And on our mothership, timesofisrael.com. Like what you hear? Consider rating us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify to spread the word.
Until next time.
Shalom.